In the blackness of the shadow-laden storage room, the executioner was pulled in tight, ready to repel any and all invaders with whatever means he had. He had a war bag full of his usual combat gear and a confiscated enemy rifle. He also had years of combat experience and a knowledge of the way the human mind worked. Hands feeling in the shadows, he found a row of lockers with his shooting hand and swiftly moved along it, feeling for a possible gap behind them. He finally found one that was open. The fit was tight, but there was no upper shelf. That made it possible to squeeze his frame into the cramped space. He tugged the locker door almost completely shut. A single flashlight swept the room, and Bolin remained still, watching the shaft of light play across the interior. After a few moments, the overhead lights in the room came on, and three men rushed inside, looking around. The men scanned the place quickly, thinking that the best hiding spots were deep within the room, instead of glancing back to the corner. Crammed in the locker, Bolin didn't have the ability to move quickly, but tucked deep into a shadow, he was almost invisible. As the men looked around the storage area, so did he, following their movements through the vent slits. The place was more than just a fuel dump, and there was enough gear to wage a whole new war. Bolin waited, seemingly for an eternity, before the trio finally turned and raced out of the room.
Find him and kill him!
The overhead lights went out. The guards had separated, seeking out the executioner in their midst. Bolin slipped out of the locker as smoothly as he could and drew his red-filtered flashlight. The short cycle of red light didn't travel far or show up in even moderate lighting. The red lens filter allowed him to see things at the space of about 10 feet with crystal clarity while making him less noticeable, even if waving it in absolute darkness. He didn't really need the torch to find the bit of shelving he was looking for. He remembered its location from when the light had been on, but he didn't want to trip over anything and make a sound. Reaching the crate, he set down his light. Bolin looked into the top and found what he was looking for, a box full of riot-control gas grenades. In the tunnels, they would be as good as gold, but only as long as Bolin could protect himself from the ravages of the choking clouds. He hadn't seen any gas masks, but he did see a box of goggles. He pulled some electrical tape from his vest. He sealed off the vent holes in the sides of one set and strapped them around his head. Bolin crouched down. He wasn't about to go searching for something to replace gas filters. He removed a wad of gauze from his first aid pouch and taped it across his chin and the bridge of his nose. It was time to let the Taliban know that their reign of terror was going to end in tears. Mareed Haytham had seen the Special Forces convoy take some bad hits after wiping out two groups of ambushers with their superior firepower. He knew full well the effectiveness of RPG-7 Soviet-designed rocket grenades, having used them in everything from laying vengeful waste to an Israeli airfield to taking out troop trucks and armored personnel carriers. The Mercedes in the lead had taken only a glancing blast, being the quicker, smaller target. However, the slower, larger Humvees had been smacked with relative ease, even by the horrible Taliban marksmen. Haytham looked at his partners, Fazood and Sariz.
We have to do something.
Like what? Fight off men armed with rockets?
The woman in the Mercedes is our best chance to track down the men from Abraham's dagger.
A temporary alliance, you mean?
Them?
Haytham raced past the shattered hulks of the two Humvees. A Taliban gunman spotted the speeding automobile, a hard-worn Russian ZIL.
Halt!
Haytham took the vehicle off-road towards two mercenaries. Fasoud pointed the muzzle of his submachine gun out the window. The Hamas man was one of the few people whom Haytham worked with who had actually trained to control his weapon and put bullets on a target. When Haytham's weapon ran dry, he ducked down, pulled his rifle, and rolled free of the car, certain that Fasoud was doing the same maneuver on the other side. Sariz didn't like the choice that Haytham had made, but that didn't keep him from aiming the Uzi at the terrorists. Scattering the remaining fighters of the ambush team was not a waste of ammo, for the time being. Haytham used the hood of the ZIL for cover and raised his Uzi as well. No return fire came. Sariz finally stepped out of the ZIL and held his Uzi towards the sky. Haytham gave him a hard shove.
What's wrong?
Gravity, you nit.
What?
Haytham quickly jumped back into the truck, then grabbed the man's shirt and yanked him into the cover of the ZIL as well.
Who's shooting at us?
You. Bullets go up and they come back down.
Gravity.
He looked out and saw Fasood clutching one arm, scowling at the men in the car.
Tweet.
He took his hand away from his shoulder, wet and glistening with blood, then looked around.
We'd better get the woman.
And the man. I'm sure that whatever happened, they called for help as soon as the first shooting started.
I thought you wanted some kind of alliance.
We'll be friendly, but we'll be friendly on our terms, all right? I'm not going to have a rifle in my hand and two vehicles full of dead or wounded American soldiers when their backup arrives.
But I still say we'll get more out of her my way.
If she doesn't help us willingly, she's all yours.
The three Palestinians raced to the battered Mercedes. They found Captain Blake and Tara Green within, both bloodied but starting to move. Haytham pointed the muzzle of his Uzi at Blake's face and shook his head.
We're not going to hurt you, but I don't have time for you to make a scene. Join us in the Zil, and we'll get you back to your people.
Blake's eyes blinked slowly as if covered with a film of gum that impeded their process. He slowly crawled out of the shattered windshield of the car, stopping on his hands and knees at Haytham's side. Fasood dug his fingers into the collar of Blake's combat vest.
Up you go.
Fasood half-dragged the stunned Special Forces captain to the ZIL while Haytham reached into the Mercedes again and found Garen, far less responsive, glazed eyes staring dreamily at him.
Garen, are you all right?
It only hurts when I breathe.
You have to be a lot more cooperative or my people are going to give you hell.
Oh, God. Did you attack the convoy?
No, but I didn't want you falling into the hands of Abraham's dagger.
You're sweet for a member of a murderous terrorist organization.
Haytham took her hand and gave a tug.
Did that hurt?
No.
Haytham pulled her along anyway, helping her get out of the overturned Mercedes. She wobbled, but she was small enough that she wasn't a burden to Haytham.
You drive, Cerise.
Why me?
Haytham glowered, staring daggers through the man.
All right. But one of these days...
If you finish that threat, you'll be dead by the time the last word leaves your lips.
Fasood leveled his Uzi on Cerise. Cerise glanced between Haytham and his loyal friend and simply got behind the steering wheel. It was going to be a real game of diplomacy to keep Captain Blake and Tara Garen alive, Haytham realized, but he knew that it was the right thing to do. It didn't make the torment whirling and churning in his soul any smoother, but it was something. The executioner hadn't planned on encountering an army in the confines of the underground bunker, and he knew that stealth and guile were, as always, going to have to be his sword and shield in combat with the Taliban mercenaries. To make the most of what tools he had, he'd come up with a plan that had flickered in his mind the moment he'd spotted the air duct. Bolin found the vent cover in the darkness and grabbed his Gerber multi-tool from his pocket. When he finished unscrewing the screws, he lifted the grill from the wall. Bolin then gathered up a couple of boxes so he could slash them open and form a large square that would completely cover the surface. For what he planned, all he needed was duct tape and a cardboard cork. He plucked the pins on five of the confiscated riot gas grenades and began hurling the bombs as far as he could down the vent. Fingers of the noxious gas were trickling out around the duct's opening. He was pleased to note that his breath and sweat-soaked swab of gauze was blocking the stinging effects of the noxious cloud. Still, he slapped up the panel of cardboard with its duct tape border and blocked the air vent. He had turned the circulation system into a bottleneck for the expanding riot gas. Bolin spun and navigated to the front, filling his hands with the AK-47 just as he reached the entrance to the storage room. Bolin paused long enough to use another tear gas grenade. It was a golden opportunity. With his enemy blinded and nauseated, they wouldn't be able to spot him among them until it was too late. The battle would be fought on a ground where he had the best footing, the best visibility, and even though the CS gas was bringing a salty sting to his nostrils and a tickle in the back of his throat through his improvised mask, he was far better off than the men whose sinuses were inflamed and whose throats were swollen tight with the scouring, almost paralyzing effects of the irritant smoke. Bolin needed a prisoner. He exploded into the hallway, parting the chemical smoke and descending upon the hapless Taliban mercenaries. Wilde's eyes stung as he staggered through the hallway, arms up, trying to keep the burning clouds from savaging and assaulting his face. It was a futile gesture, and he knew that if he had a mask, it would be easier. But there were no such masks just lying around the well-equipped underground compound. Plenty of supplies had been left behind by the Russian devils when their occupation was broken, but it was a crapshoot as to what was to be found where. He had plenty of ammunition for the rifle in his hands, and grenades on his belt, and food to fill his stomach. That was what had mattered 10 minutes before, when the quiet little bunker was just a place for him to rest his head while the strangers from Egypt were assembling his brethren for an assault on the enemies of Allah. That was before the gunshots and the panicked response to an invader who had penetrated into a supposedly impenetrable bunker. He was amazed that all that came out of his sandpapered throat was thick, clear mucus and not sticky blood. His lungs burned incredibly. He paused as a tall form stepped through the fog, AK in hand. The buttstock of the rifle had hit Wilde above his navel. He staggered, folding over the strike. The cold floor had met his face after an elbow landed on his neck. Light flashed inside his skull like a burst of lightning as he curled on the cold concrete floor. He glanced up at the tall figure, chemical smoke swirling around it like it was the center of a dust devil. Wilde shuffled back from the big wraith. The giant figure lashed out with a long, powerful arm to backhand another of his allies. Two more men staggered to grab him, fingers curled into claws, as much in pain as in the need to hook the intruder's flesh. Instead, their hands groped at empty air, the flickering figure disappearing between them. From nowhere, a long leg snapped up. The body of the second man lay near Wilde's feet. Gathering as much of his will to fight as he could, Wilde clawed for the pistol in his belt. The man whirled, eyes flashing in reflection from the hazy, fogged-over lights, then flicked out his hand. Spears of agony had plunged into Wilde's shoulder. His clavicle was broken, his body twisted in pain, his fingers now useless. Iron hard fingers wrapped around his throat.
How many of you are there?
Please, in Allah's name, I beseech you!
Allah doesn't care about a rapist and murderer of children.
Wilde felt his genitals shrink in horror, his entrails twisting into a tight, cold ball up against his spine.
Your only hope is to tell me what you're doing here. Tell me why you are trespassing in the lair of the Russian devils.
We were told to come here by the warriors from Egypt who claims to be the chosen of Allah.
We? How many?
There were 90 of us this morning. Now there are only but 15.
Where did they go?
Some went to capture a Jewish woman.
And the others?
They were meant to launch an attack.
Where?
An American base.
Suddenly the weight was off his chest and broken collarbone. Wilde never thought he would find the noxious gas to be as sweet as the scent of flower petals. His eyes blinked with gummy slowness, but when he looked around, there was no one standing in the hall with him. With a trembling hand, he clutched his shoulder, bending over. He and his brethren had been spared from the full wrath of an angry god. Bolin realized that the doomsday numbers were tumbling out of his control. Abraham's dagger was turning to face its foes head-on. That left Terra Garen vulnerable to a counterattack. There were once 90 men, and only 15 had been left behind. Bolin couldn't even begin to figure how many he'd already encountered. There were another 20 or 30 at the least. Abraham's dagger had to have had an entire army. Passing storage areas, he spotted littered remains of opened crates of weapons, rifles, and rocket launchers, and grenades discarded next to the emptied containers. He took inventory on the run. The trail of unconscious men grew longer, but the clues ahead of him were shortening to a dread conclusion. The assassins had located their prey, and they were going to make every effort to eradicate them. Bolin was long behind in the chase. He flipped open his phone, but the concrete and earth over his head effectively cut off the signal. He was going to have to get to the surface. That meant getting back to the entrance. The executioner whirled. Once more, the remaining Taliban mercenaries were mustering their forces to repel this invader, and when they cleared the stinging cloud of gas, they'd have a relatively clear view of him. Pivoting on one foot, Bolin ripped the Uzi pistol and the Desert Eagle from their respective holsters. Shadows burst through the cloud, hobbling along, some clutching broken jaws, others with their faces contorted in chemical-induced pain, all of them lunging as one single-minded entity. Through their blurry vision, they saw a tower of a man, wisps of smoke swirling at his feet, his face an inhuman mask behind a soiled black improvised gas mask and flashing goggles.
You have the chance to leave here alive.
Bolin's fingers rested lightly but securely on the triggers of his weapons.
Move aside.
The group of men parted and Bolin lowered his guns, striding past them. He felt their gaze on him. And though he could smell the stink of his own sweat and breath through the gauze pad, he could smell their fear as well. He'd proved himself to them as something they had no hope of standing against, and in their weakened moment of doubt, they folded completely. Bolin didn't run, and he didn't turn back. He strode through the tunnels to the entrance. None of the Taliban dared lift a finger to stop him. If only it would be so easy against Abraham's dagger, Bolin thought. Robert Wesley returned to headquarters, realizing that it had grown more crowded by at least twice the number. He also noticed that half the Special Forces team was gone as well. He walked up to the warrant officer, Terence Ogden, the executive officer of the command post while Captain Blake was in the field.
What the hell's happening?
Jesus, things have been going crazy over here. Blake went out to pick up that Colonel Stone last night.
Wesley had expected as much, but kept quiet about it, looking around at the newcomers in the command post. From their uniforms, he could tell that they were Marine Corps, and from the lack of name panels and rank insignias, he figured that they were Force Recon or Marine Expeditionary. He raised an eyebrow at Ogden.
The Jarheads came in last night after Blake moved out to talk to Stone. We just got an emergency radio transmission about 8 minutes ago. We're loading up as many people as we can and moving out.
What's wrong?
Strap into your combat gear. Blake and the convoy came under fire. We've been trying to raise our people, but there's been no response so far.
Good God.
He looked at the group. Jared and Montenegro had gone with Blake. Those two were particularly close friends of his.
Had they picked up Stone and Rosenberg?
They reported they were bringing Rosenberg back. Stone flattened Blake and the three guys with him and took off running.
Wesley tightened his combat vest across his chest and cinched his helmet in place.
This is getting more and more fucked up.
No kidding. I'm glad you made it. I didn't want to leave this joint to the Marines.
No. We're going to have them backing us up on this retrieval.
Yeah, fortunately we have a strong GPS transponder signal from one of the Hummers, and there's an emergency beacon giving us another signal.
A red-faced Marine wearing mirrored shades stepped up.
You're joining this little field trip?
Yeah, Staff Sergeant Robert Wesley, Intelligence and Heavy Weapons.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant John Bannon, good to be working with you.
Wesley accepted the man's handshake. The two men turned and started for the vehicles outside.
How bad is this going to be? You seem to have an idea what's got the Marines in bed with the Special Forces.
Renegade Israelis, Hamas, the Taliban, and to top it all off, a bunch of innocent UN doctors and care workers.
The sergeant took a step when something flickered in his peripheral vision. It wasn't even conscious thought that sent him sailing towards Bannon. The Green Beret looked up at the rooftop surrounding his headquarters and spotted a dozen bodies and a dozen rifles all looming over them.
We're under attack!
Laith Khan wasn't going to sit still, not when he had the opportunity to do some good. The colonel had explained that he'd get into enough action soon enough, but the young Afghan didn't think that Stone would mind a non-combat mission of sorts. Dr. Michaela Bronson, sitting next to him in the jeep, looked skeptical of the Afghan warrior's logic, however.
Listen, Doctors Koenig and Takeda are going to be fine at Makaki.
Just like Sophia Della Roque and a few dozen co-workers and patients were safe?
The doctor pursed her lips, her eyes turning to the road in front of them.
And let's not forget your adventures last night at your supposedly safe hospital. Makaki is a heavily overworked camp with thousands upon thousands of people living in shanties around it. The camp security wouldn't notice a strike force until their brains were exiting their skulls at over 1,000 feet per second.
All right!
I'm sorry.
You didn't have to describe everything in gory detail.
Michaela's dark eyes scanned the horizon as they moved along. Morning was dawning quickly, and Laith could tell that exhaustion was getting to her.
Laith?
Laith, where are you?
I'm heading to Makaki. The last two witnesses to the Shafiq massacre are working there.
I thought I told you to stay put. Is Dr. Bronson with you?
Yeah, she's with me.
Laith, Abraham's dagger has at least 75 heavily armed Taliban veterans out in force today. Some of them went to capture Terra, and the rest are being given orders to attack other zones.
You know where?
I didn't see any records, and I don't think Abraham's dagger would be stupid enough to leave anything in writing for me. But my educated guess would be the Special Forces HQ at Chaman and the camp at Makaki. And you're going to be rolling right down the throat of an ambush.
But you came here to stop the murders of the witnesses.
I know that.
So where are you? What are you going to do?
I'll think of something.
Lathe stared at the road ahead of him.
What?
That was Colonel Stone. The men who wanted you dead last night are going to make an assault on Makaki camp to get the remaining two doctors. And they're going to attack the Special Forces HQ at Chamin. They're also going to capture the Israeli woman who was with us last night.
But how?
Yeah, it would take hundreds of men for them to do that. My brother has about 100 men, but there is no way you could get them to either place in time to make a difference. And if what Colonel Stone says is right, then the U.S. military is coming under the hammer right about now.
All those people, though. There are 5,000 refugees at Makaki.
I know that. And those are my people. Afghans. Real Afghans. Not some punks who thought it would be fun to load up a truck and go shoot some Ruskies to get themselves into paradise.
I'm sorry. Is there anything we can do?
I just got through talking to the one man I trust to let me know when we can do something.
Can he do anything?
Lathe kept quiet, realizing that every second he kept his foot on the gas, winding down the road to Makaki, he was breaking the big man's rules of engagement. Orders or not, Lathe couldn't sit by and let an army of thugs sweep down on his defenseless people. Mac Bolan was pushing the Land Rover to its limits, knowing that the alignment and the undercarriage were taking a pounding, even their legendary reputation wouldn't stand up to for long. He had his phone open and was about to dial Marid Haytham's number.
Colonel Stone.
What's wrong, Haytham?
It's Tara Garan, sir.
Where are you? Is she all right?
My partners are debating giving you our location, but she's okay. Well, she's alive. She took a beating, and so did Captain Blake.
Abraham's dagger launched an assault on their convoy.
Exactly. Listen, I know we promised a truce between our sides, but the men I'm working with aren't too interested in honoring words exchanged with Americans and Jews.
And you?
The Israeli military murdered my family, Colonel. Do you comprehend how it feels to wake up one day and realize the people you love are dead, and you are completely impotent to do anything about it?
My father, mother, and sister died just like that, Haytham. You don't need to explain to me what loss is.
My apologies.
You couldn't know.
We need to know where Abraham's dagger is. We have to act against them. It is the only bargaining chip I have available against my partners.
Tell me where you are, or get a force up and ready to meet me somewhere neutral. Bring Blake and Garen along, too.
Let me try to convince my people. I'll call you back.
Right. What?
Colonel Stone, we're under attack in Chamin.
I know. How are you holding out?
Pretty damn bad. They're blowing the hell out of this place and not giving us any chance to respond. They took us by surprise. I'd like to blame the Marines for distracting us, but these guys were given good placement, and I don't like speaking ill of the dead.
Marines?
Force Recon. Colonel Stone, we need reinforcements.
I might have some help coming your way.
Marid Haytham turned back to the 8 Palestinians who watched him like hawks.
Any reason why the Americans aren't answering our calls?
I don't know, Cerise, but Colonel Stone took my call. He sounded like he was in a hurry, but he was willing to meet at a neutral location if you didn't want to talk with him here.
Baraz, a burly man over 6 feet tall, walked over to Haytham.
You're going soft in the head as well as the heart. If he comes here, the Americans are just going to kill us all.
Listen, there are as many Americans who are as sympathetic to the cause of a Palestine free of Israeli oppression as there are who buy completely into the lies of the Jews.
That's right, Fasood. This is a man who spoke to me as an equal and with trust. He had me outnumbered last night, and he had more than enough firepower to kill me or capture me. Instead, we parted under a flag of peace.
Because he wanted to track you down and kill all of us.
I'm getting tired of your mouth, Saris. It was your bloody bullet that hit me, not anyone else's. You shot me, you twit!
Haytham saw the group of Palestinians split up. Only one other man, Salil, stood with him and Fasood, leaving it 6-3 odds in favor of the hardcore Hamas soldiers.
Fasood, it's all right.
The big man was about to argue, but he saw the look in Haytham's eyes and nodded, cooling down. Haytham tossed Salil a glance, and he also wordlessly accepted the stand down.
I'm going to call Colonel Stone, and we'll take Blake and Garen to another location.
The Jew bitch stays here.
Cerise's knife glinted from his fist.
We need to get acquainted.
I don't have time for this.
The executioner followed the columns of smoke burning into the sky on the way back from the former Soviet base. The asphalt was chewed up by what he quickly recognized as the effects of a 40-millimeter grenade launcher. He spotted two Humvees at roadside. Each of the vehicles was smoldering, sporting gaping holes where smoke poured out. Bolin brought his war bag with a well-stocked medical kit to the Humvees. He looked around at the wreckage.
Over here, Colonel!
Bolin recognized the man. It was Sergeant Jared, and he was kneeling at the top of a roadside ditch, rifle at the ready. Bolin raced over.
Who's hurt?
Bolin knelt to pull out his kit. He counted the men. There were only three, and he instantly recognized the one who was wounded as Sergeant Montenegro. Another Green Beret was resting on one elbow, his face a mass of bruises.
Just Montenegro, sir.
And the others?
Just what you see.
Bolin knelt by Montenegro, who already had a bandage pressed to the side of his neck.
Shrapnel, sir. Bounced off the clavicle, went through the trapezius muscle. He's bleeding a lot, and he's gone into shock. We've already used our supply of Ringer solution to keep him stable.
I'm sorry.
He was about to do something when the other man reached for the medical kit.
Sergeant McCorkindale. I bet I'm a little more qualified than you are. Trouble is, my kit's burning up.
Go ahead. Jared, you're pretty much on your own for the time being. The team's HQ is under attack in Shaman.
Shit on a stick, sir.
No backup is going to pick you up. And I can move the three of you if you want.
That would be good. But what about Blake and the woman?
Did you see what happened?
Well, the Tally Mooks were all celebrating having taken us down and were around Blake's Mercedes. When the big black Zill comes roaring up and a bunch of Arabs pop out and start shooting. If I had more motor controls than to barely crawl out of my Hummer, I'd have thrown in with them. They were righteous shooters. It was two guys who did most of the ass-kicking, though.
Bolin wasn't going to ask for a description, but he knew who at least one of the men was.
What happened next?
This bald little prick hops out after the shooting's over and empties his gun into the sky. And the lead dude, a guy with a beard like a local, jams him into the car before the bullets come back down to earth. Asshole ended up clipping the other guy from the Zill, a big guy, about your height, about 50, 60 pounds heavier.
How'd they treat Blake and Garen?
Blake got a gun waved in his face, but it seemed more like a matter of formality. Garen, the girl?
The one you know is Rosenberg.
She was treated a little better. Helped to walk to the Russian car. Who were they, sir?
Hamas. It's a long story.
Hell, I'll believe Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock at this point. I'm just glad to be alive. And I'll be even more glad if we can keep Montenegro kicking.
Quit talking about me in third person. I'll live.
Bolin sized up the tall man, lips pale and gray, eyes sunken, one arm strapped tight to his side.
I'll take your word for it.
It looks worse than it feels.
That's called morphine and Demerol, dimwit. You're taking it easy.
Easy isn't in our vocabulary today, gentlemen. Get into the Land Rover. I'm gonna see if I can salvage anything. Did you collect anything?
Jared held up three chains with plastic-encased dog tags.
They're coming with us, Colonel. But please, we have to send someone for their bodies.
We will. We just have to get out of this alive.
Reb Steiner glanced at Olson Roden, the sadness having left his anger-hardened eyes. Ever since the previous night, with the death of Soze and with the escape of Mareed Haytham, he had become a changed man.
I told you I didn't want you making hard contact with the enemy.
Shut up, you spineless bastard.
Listen.
You listen. I've seen this mystery man at work. Suddenly, you get a tail between your legs and are launching all kinds of sloppy attacks. You're attacking Green Berets and refugee camps. And why? Because you're afraid of someone who matches the legend of a devil. I've seen him through the scope of my rifle. He's human.
Roden shook Steiner's hand away, terror making his heart hammer a mile a minute.
Then if he's human, he's not going to be able to get in our way for the hits on Takeda and Koenig.
The convoy they were in, heading for Makaki, was a dozen vehicles long, but the plan was to abandon the trucks long before they got to the outskirts of the camp. Getting the heavy transports through thousands of people in tents and improvised huts around the refugee camp would have proved nearly impossible, even with a bulldozer or a couple of tanks.
So you say. It all depends on what he decides his priority is. As it is, Stamen never answered back from the ambush on Captain Blake and the Garen woman.
A communications error. They couldn't have failed. They had rocket-propelled grenades.
Against at least half of a Special Forces team and their vehicles. I swear, if Stamen is dead, I'll kill you myself.
You let Soze down!
Steiner's thick arms went taut. Roden wondered if he'd just invited the sad-eyed assassin to twist the skull from his shoulders for use as a kickball. Fists the size and shape of hams flexed and tensed. The Abraham's Dagger commander had watched Steiner shatter the necks of grown men with a single punch from those brutal hands. If Steiner was going to punch Roden, the Dagger leader took consolation in that he wouldn't feel death. Steiner relaxed.
You're right, Roddy.
The sooner we're out of this forsaken country, the better. But we have to cover ourselves. We have to show the world that those who coddle the Palestinians are not safe anywhere.
Mac Bolan leaned on the Land Rover's accelerator. As the road raced past them, Afghanistan became a blur.
Stone, you're gonna open up Montenegro!
Let him drive, Doc. He's got lives to save.
At the cost of our own—
Shut your fucking pie hole, Mac!
Bolan kept his concentration on the road, fingers tight around the steering wheel. Haytham had contacted him while he was stripping gear from the shattered Humvees. Even though Bolan hated looting the vehicles of fallen fellow soldiers, he was a practical man. Supplies were needed, and he said a moment of silent thanks to the three dead American soldiers who had given their all. Now, all that was left was what Uncle Sam had issued them, and he was going to make as much use as he could of what still worked. This wasn't the safest driving he'd ever done, but without an aircraft, there was no faster way to get to Haytham's side before the attack on the Hamas men and their captives was over. Abraham's Dagger had tracked down the Palestinians to their headquarters in Afghanistan and were sending a third prong of their assault against the unaware enemies. Had Tara Guerin and Jason Blake not been their prisoners, the executioner wouldn't have thought twice about going to Haytham's rescue. Then a twinge of guilt filled him as the outskirts of Chaman loomed in the distance. Marid Haytham was a man Bolan could understand. He was a man who was dragged into a war, driven by loss and pain. Where Bolan had turned himself into a living shield to defend the innocent, Haytham had forged himself as a sword, driving down on the men he assumed were responsible for the deaths of his loved ones. That he didn't harm bystanders was all that the executioner needed to know about the true state of Haytham's soul. The man was tortured and made a promise to himself that he'd never let another suffer as he had. The exact same vow that drove Max Samuel Bolan to risk his life every single day. At least three lives were worth saving, one to be given the chance for redemption. He swung the Land Rover down the quiet streets. In the distance, he saw smoke curling up from buildings on far parts of town. One he knew instantly as Captain Blake's improvised headquarters. The other, the closer one, was where the Palestinians had been holed up.
It's Haytham, Colonel. They've lost another man.
We're closing in.
He says they don't have much time.
Bolan's eyes narrowed to a squint, and he twisted the steering wheel around.
Nobody does, Sergeant, but I'm working on it.
Tara Guerin, wrists bound tightly behind her, had awakened the moment the wall had blown in. She recalled a hazy memory of being surrounded by Palestinian men arguing her fate when an explosion had gone off, throwing her across the room. Blake had skidded to a halt next to her, eyes wide with shock. Marid Haytham loomed over them, cell phone pressed to his ear, knife in one hand, the blade glimmering in the light. Her throat constricted for the briefest of moments, then Haytham reached behind her. She felt that her wrists were suddenly free.
What's going on?
Abraham's Dagger must have found us. Now they want you in their hands or all of us dead. Take this knife, get Blake loose. We're going to need all the help we can get.
Haytham, if they spot us with guns...
Shoot them back then, it'll be no loss.
Guerin was stunned by the comment, but flipped the penknife in her hand. Blake squirmed around, giving her a chance to get at his bonds. A shadow moved into her peripheral vision. Her body, though battered and bruised, still reacted like a machine, and she dove to one side. Rolling onto her shoulder, she came up on her feet, the penknife held parallel to her index finger. Guerin looked into the eyes of a balding madman. Amal Sariz, the man Mossad had called one of the 10 most mentally unstable members of Hamas, grinned.
You're not even going to get a chance to hold a gun, bitch. I'm going to cut you from scalp to toes, and you're going to enjoy every minute of it.
The grenade explosion had sent Sergeant Robert Wesley diving flat on the ground, but a moment later he was up and running to the cover of the office building, M4 Sopmod bouncing in its shoulder sling until he got behind some heavy stonework. Marines and Green Berets had found their cover as soon as the waves of rifle fire had started. The enemy seemed to have a small supply of explosives, much less than he would have expected, but that was a blessing as far as Wesley was concerned. He flipped on his lash.
Ogden, we're going to get our boys up roofside in action?
There was no response over the main frequency. He tried adjusting the volume.
Ow!
He yanked out his earpiece. Bannon slid in beside Wesley like he was stealing second base. The Marine scrambled to his feet, his mirrored shades long since lost, green eyes wide, red face a mass of freckles.
You guys sure know how to throw a welcome party. Hell, you should see us when we have more warning. Usually it's strippers and big hooters jumping out of 55-gallon drums.
Wow! I'll have to try that sometime.
He shouldered his M4, scanning rooftops, then ducking back under cover.
No good! They got the high ground!
Well, their marksmanship is shit at least. They're doing just enough to keep our heads down.
I don't like being stuck in a defensive position. How's your communications?
Someone's left us with space noise, man. I'm thinking that the renegade Israelis has some pretty spiffy tech going to shut us down.
Calm ammo and water is what keeps the unit going, and they knocked out one-third of that. And given the response we threw up when the shooting started.
The Lord knows how long the ammo's going to last. Luckily, we calmed down back to training.
Wesley poked his head out, looking for an enemy to target. Special Forces soldiers had learned that a light tap of the trigger resulted in more hits against the enemy than trying to wrestle against the recoil of a rifle on full auto. Hits were what counted, and that was what made the odds more even. Marksmanship and proper cover proving to be a good way to increase the effectiveness of a unit. Bannon yanked Wesley back behind cover. Wesley realized that the Taliban soldiers were making a textbook example of how even expert use of cover was enough to make the odds between professional soldiers and bullying thugs a draw.
As much as I appreciate you being bait, I'd prefer to keep you on the live side of this battle.
Thanks. Listen, can you cover me? We have a rooftop hide where I can get a better view of all the bad guys hemming us in.
And maybe get to take some pot shots at them too?
Sniper's roost. Sharpshooter 7.
Hey, Gun! Blaster! Get your asses over here!
Wesley swung out, bringing his M4 to his shoulder. The two Marines that Bannon had summoned dashed wildly from their respective hiding places to his side.
These two girls happen to be the best snipers in my unit.
A quick glance told Wesley that no more than the four men he'd seen wounded in the initial volley were still out there, being cared for by fellow soldiers who held their ground, refusing to leave a buddy behind. It made the Green Beret's heart swell with pride. They might be outgunned, outmanned, and surrounded, but there was courage in this little office compound today. The men wouldn't break, not for anything.
All right, Hickok and Plaster, we have to run to that door. Think you can make it and not get shot?
Hickok, a tall, lanky man with thick, curly black hair and dark, ruddy skin, looked at the gauntlet they had to run.
Well, unless it's like a sack race and I got Plaster here slowing me down, I reckon I can make it. You're gonna have to toss Plaster, though. He don't run nowhere near quick as me.
Plaster, a spread hand taller than 5 feet by Wesley's figuring, wrinkled his nose.
You could walk the distance and not get your narrow ass hit. Don't mind this moron. He needs to wear a straw to cast a shadow.
Enough grab-assing. Get up to the roof and start shooting before they start getting lucky again.
Wesley charged, boots digging into the dirt. The look on Jared's face told the whole story to the executioner as he swiftly tore himself out of his tan BDUs and pulled down the sleeves of the skin-tight combat black suit.
Colonel!
You're staying with me here with Montenegro and McCorkendale. Whether you do it with or without a broken jaw, make your decision now so I can get to Blake and Rosenberg that much faster.
Jared was speechless for a moment, giving the executioner an opportunity to throw on his load-bearing harness and the holsters for the Desert Eagle and the Uzi pistol. He then rubbed black grease paint across his face, taking on the appearance of a blackened mask, his grim features distinguished only by the startling ice blue of the eyes freezing Jared in place.
I'll stay with the Land Rover, sir.
Good.
Bolin grabbed the head weapon he knew he was going to need for this fight, an M4 Sopmod with a grenade launcher attachment. It was smaller than the M16 M203 he usually took with him, but it still fired a 40mm grenade with earth-shaking power. And out of the shorter barrel of the M4, the 5.56mm bullets it spat still had man-stopping force at close quarters. The three Green Berets looked at him slack-jawed, eyes wide with wonder. Bolin didn't blame them. He had transformed from a relatively normal-looking man into over 6 feet of solid black, a human shadow bristling with handguns, knives, grenades, rifles, and spare ammunition. Stealth wasn't the executioner's goal, not in this instance. He wanted impact, and the impression he got from the faces of the Special Forces soldiers conveyed every ounce of the power he carried with him.
Who are you, Colonel?
That's the baddest mother ever to walk the earth.
Bolin simply shook his head. In a flicker of movement, he whirled and was off, racing toward the group of gunmen who were hemming in the Palestinians. It wasn't difficult for the executioner to pin down the location of the Taliban gunmen. His eyes swept their positions. Their attention was fixated on the Palestinians' headquarters, a two-story apartment building that had seen better days even before the RPG-7 shell had planted its 84mm warhead into the ancient stone, shearing off a corner of the roof large enough to drive a Cadillac through. Bolin sighted a couple of gunners racing toward the front of the building, their aim to penetrate the building and begin clearing it out from the inside, while the defenders were occupied on protecting their perimeter. He decided to cut them off in mid-run with a 40mm HE grenade. 6 ounces of high explosive had announced that the executioner had arrived. Dozens of eyes stared at the black wraith who had entered the war grounds, minds struggling to cope with the sudden shock. A mouth opened in alarm.
Introductions are over.
It was time to earn the rest of his victory. The explosion had distracted Sariz, but not Terragera. Not when she had one of the most dangerous men in the Middle East facing her down. Hesitation was tantamount to suicide, and fighting fair would only result in her being carved up like sandwich meat. With a half-step, she lunged at Sariz. Garen's blade had found the flesh it sought, slicing through Sariz's shirt and pants, opening a cut that was a foot long but only a half inch deep. It was enough to jar Sariz from his confusion, however. He swung his forearm towards the side of Garen's head. The tough little Israeli had gone with the force of the blow, letting it redirect her. Sariz's knife sliced at empty air. Garen twisted her legs underneath her, spinning to her feet and allowing herself an uncontrolled stumble backward, letting gravity and her own wobbly legs make her a nearly impossible target. Just inches separated her from the shimmering afterimage of the Hamas killer's knife. She used the wall for balance and snapped up one foot. She shoved off, closing distance with the penknife in her hand. Garen was about to press her advantage with the knife when Sariz pivoted on one foot, bringing his heel up. Pain burned like an inferno up and down her torso. Teeth clenched, she forced herself to all fours, then spotted something out of the corner of her eye. With a hard push, she launched herself backward as Sariz came down with his leg. Wild, hate-filled eyes swiveled to lock onto her as she leaned back on her haunches.
You missed.
She leaped to her feet, fingers extending like claws.
My turn, fuckhole!
Her blunt-nailed fingers sank into the soft flesh of the Palestinian's cheeks, skin beginning to tear at her death grip on his face. Despite his punch, Garen didn't let go. Blinded with his own blood, Cerise flailed away. Although she ached from the impacts, she was able to ignore the blows. Terra wrenched her hands around and plunged both of her thumbs into his eyes. She reached down and dug into his belt for the pistol. She looked up and was surprised to see none of the Palestinians seemed to give a damn about the death struggle going on among them. She pressed the pistol into the ruined man's mouth, his hands preoccupied with trying to scrape the remnants of his features back together. Garen's heart hammered in her chest as she looked at the destruction she'd wrought. By now, Blake had pulled himself half free and was reaching for the penknife that had been knocked free during the course of the battle. Haytham ran from a window and picked up the blade to help out Blake.
He attacked me!
I know. It doesn't matter now. We have to get moving. Colonel Stone has arrived.
Colonel Stone?
He was the only one I could reach. He's fighting our attackers.
With how many men?
Blake glanced out the window. His face went pale for a moment, and Haytham dragged him back out of sight.
How many?
He was alone.
That man would fight alone, unarmed, and naked to protect those who needed him. And you had cause to doubt him?
Garen smiled through the pain of 1,000 bruises and maybe a broken bone.
I never doubted him.
The executioner dropped his doubts behind him. There was no sign yet of any of the soldiers from Abraham's Dagger, but that didn't make him feel any better. Just because an enemy soldier wasn't visible on a battlefield didn't mean he wasn't out there. Bolan had won most of his fights because he wasn't a visible target, able to strike first and fast in the shadows and fade away again. That wasn't the case this time, however. He had to fight to protect an ambushed set of defenders, and the executioner knew the best way to draw the fire away from a surrounded firebase was to leave big footprints on the back of the attackers. He didn't count how many he'd chopped down with the slashing bursts from his rifle, but between his attacks and the sniping from the hemmed-in Palestinians, the assault was breaking up nicely. Bolan took cover behind an old Yugo, feeding a fresh 40mm shell into the grenade launcher. Just because the attack was breaking up didn't mean that he wasn't still under attack. The executioner was glad he had the full length of the car to protect him. Reloaded, he swung around the left front fender, aiming at a clot of dug-in gunmen. The window front they had been fighting behind had suddenly become a volcano of black smoke and charred body parts. Bolan let the mostly empty rifle drop on its sling, drawing his Desert Eagle as an instant reload, as a Taliban mercenary lunged from cover. Bolan crouched for cover, then made a hand gesture to one of the Palestinian gunmen up high. The man caught the movement, and for a moment, Bolan wasn't sure if the Hamas man was going to pull the trigger on him or help him out. The executioner pointed ahead toward the battle-shocked street. Smoldering corpses lay askew amid chunks of rubble. The Palestinian jerked out of sight when a group of terrorists focused on his position. Nolan reacted instantly, leveling the Desert Eagle at two men with rifles who were now visible to him, partially obscured by a chest-high wall. Only their heads and rifles had been visible, but the powerful Magnum pistol easily had the accuracy to hit a target the size of a melon. He had watched two nearly decapitated terrorists tumble lifelessly, no longer threatening the Palestinian who was giving them his bird's-eye view. The man popped out and gave the soldier a thumbs up. Bolan spotted a bloodied bandage on his arm, and the executioner remembered the story that Jared had given him. This had to have been Haytham's partner in rescuing Blake and Tara, the one hit by the overzealous idiot's hail of bullets. He gave a quick point, then ducked back behind cover. The executioner turned and looked for the target the Palestinian had indicated. He caught a flash of movement and hit the ground. Flat on his chest, Bolan plucked the Uzi pistol from the shoulder holster. His arm felt slick, hot, and wet, and he knew that his blood was soaking through the bandage. Bolan looked away from the injury, scanning for sources of new pain. That's when a pair of hands shot out of a doorway, grabbing him around the head and neck, pulling him back into the depths of the building.